She's always been the type of person that just says things and she just speaks her mind. I guess that has a little bit to do with not having a formal education.
Welcome to another episode of The Body Serve. I believe this is our fourth, and we just got word that we've been picked up for a full season.
Yes, congratulations to us.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've also made it through our very first Grand Slam together for the purposes of a podcast, so this is pretty exciting too.
And this is the most difficult one, scheduling-wise.
In terms of the actual tournament, right?
Yes, late hours.
Well, they've been later for me than for you.
This is true.
You're far more rested than I am at this point.
I've decided not to stay up to 7:30 in the morning to watch the men's matches.
Yeah, the finals weekend was rough. I think I went to bed at 7 both nights.
And, you know, we have lives.
Yeah, full-time jobs even. Gotta pay the bills. Mm-hmm. The dog's gotta eat. So, the tournament's over. We have two winners. Mm-hmm. And you... You can gloat.
They were actually the ones I chose. Is that what you were getting at?
That is what I was getting at. They were very safe picks.
Thank you.
To pick.
That's another word for correct.
You picked both number one seeds to win, and Serena and Novak both came up trumps.
They did. You know, it was a real lack of creativity on my part, picking them, but it was correct. So there.
Look at you practicing some humility. My picks were Stan and Simona, and that didn't work too well.
Yeah, they were like the indie picks, you know?
Well, Stan was looking really good after his quarterfinal against Kay. That was probably the best we've seen him play since a year ago when he won Australia, and then it just didn't happen against Novak.
Yeah, it was a real stinker of a five-setter, wasn't it? Five-setters can be bad.
We've seen a lot of bagel sets on the men's side.
Yeah, on both sides, actually. But it's more surprising on the men's.
It is. I was treading lightly on that. We left off our previous podcast with surveying the final 16 that were left in the tournament. So before we get into talking about the finals and who won, let's backtrack a little bit and pick up where we left off with the quarterfinals and semifinals.
Okay. Let's.
On the women's side, the two matches that really stood out heading into the quarterfinals were Venus and Madison, and then Maria and Bouchard. Venus and Madison delivered, although the tennis was spotty in patches. Mm-hmm. And you could say, it was really one-way traffic in the Sharapova-Bouchard match.
Yeah, it was sort of reflective of the whole women's bottom half. You know, both women's quarters in that half were poor. They were not exciting.
Well, this is something that you've been talking about for the entire 2 weeks, about how poor and uneven the bottom half of the women's draw was.
Yeah, you know, I'm no conspiracy theorist when it comes to the draws. I think it's done fairly, but, you know, it was a pretty easy path to the final for Maria. And we saw that from the very first round. You know, a lot of people predicted that. There weren't really a lot of players who trouble her standing in her way.
Well, Maria and Bouchard was the marquee matchup in a lot of ways, especially on the bottom half.
For the powers that be.
Yes. And so there was a high level of interest for that match, and Bouchard just isn't quite there yet. When Maria is playing her best, the difference in play between the two is quite stark.
Yeah. And Bouchard has, you know, those really sort of hitchy strokes. And they're really thrown into relief against Sharapova, who doesn't have a beautiful game either, but by contrast, you know, you could really tell. It just seems like Bouchard is really in need of a coach. You know, she didn't really have any answers. Now, the standout match in the women's quarters, I would say, is definitely Venus versus Madison Keys.
We got a long three-set match. We got a lot of power hitting, a lot of big serves. It was an All-American matchup. It was what we were told... the mentor playing against the mentee. the idol.
The changing of the guard.
Uh-huh. And it was exciting. The quality of tennis was a little bit up and down throughout.
Mm-hmm.
But there was lots to really pull from that match. One of the things that I really took away from that was how promising Madison Keys is going forward.
Absolutely.
We saw it against Venus, and then we saw it again against Serena, which was an even stiffer test, how powerful her strokes are.
And this cliche in tennis about easy power, you know, that's something that applies to Madison more than any of the younger players, I think.
I've never really bought into that until now. Because there were so many times when you'd see her hit a what seemed to be a casual ground stroke that just kept pushing Venus back beyond the baseline. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think even Venus thought she had more time to hit some of those shots before she actually got to it. And for her, who has such an elongated setup for her strokes, it really was a problem for her in that match.
Right. Yeah, we've seen Madison kind of out-hit the Williams sisters back-to-back, you know, which is not easy to do. But the Williams sort of continued this power game that Monica Seles was kind of, you know, the godmother of, and it's gotten faster and faster. The Williams sisters have obviously stayed at the forefront, but to see them be kind of pushed back and sort of befuddled by some of Madison's shots, that was interesting.
It's clear that she's the next level of power tennis. Mm-hmm. And the difference for her this week was that she seemed a little bit more prepared and had a lot more self-belief than she normally does.
Yeah.
She's always had the power, but she was able to rein it in, pick her spots more, and play a more consistent game.
Yeah, I think the reason that Serena and Venus have been around so long, well, one of the reasons, is that, you know, a lot of players can hit with them for, say, a set and a half. You know, Camilla Giorgi, Petra Kvitova, you know, they can really smack them around the court. But the problem is keeping it within the lines. And for Kvitova, keeping it on the court.
And even if you do manage it for one match, you then have to win six more. Mm-hmm. And we saw Madison take out. It wasn't just the Williams sisters that she played and played well against. She beat Kvitova as well.
Yes.
Then she took out Venus. That first set she played, there was no way, even if Venus played her best, that Venus was going to come back and win that match had Madison kept that level throughout.
Right.
That's how impressive she was, I felt. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, most players can't keep that level for the whole match. And I think, you know, Venus really looked flat to start, and she looked a little fatigued and maybe just a little mentally exhausted. And I don't think that takes away from Madison's performance. That's not where I'm going with this.
No, because Madison herself wasn't at her best in that match.
Right.
So they kind of neutralized each other in that regard. It ended up just being a matter of Madison finding her range toward the end of the third set.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Venus was... She didn't look to be the player who beat Radwanska in the previous round.
Definitely not the one who played that first set against Radwanska.
Right. And, you know, a match like that is going to take a lot out of anyone, I think. Mentally and physically. But, you know, Madison was battling her own injury problems. Venus seemed a little slow to balls. And it's hard to tell on TV if she could have made an attempt to reach some of these balls, if they're going just too fast and they were too far away from her. It's really difficult to tell.
It's hard to tell if some of it was due to her failing to adjust to Madison's power, because that in itself would have been a new thing for her trying to figure out on the fly as well.
Mm.
And there was also the element that Venus had played her previous match at night in the fourth round against Radwanska, and then she came back again to play the first match on Laver for the quarterfinals. So compared to the normal rest that she had been getting in the tournament, this was a little bit of a shorter break mm-hmm. for her. I'm not really willing to go as far as to say that or to speculate what part, you know, Sjogren's may have played in this. I think that's the worry that we have whenever we have Venus playing. You know, we're always on the lookout for signs that maybe she's not physically well because of it. But her play has been so outstanding to start the year that I'm just going to just leave it to Madison's great play.
Right.
That's the thing that I'm going to take away most from it.
Mm. Because Venus didn't play a bad match, you know, and it's definitely a great tournament. And I think she's probably leaving, if not satisfied, happy.
And we all know that even when Venus was at her best, playing regularly on top of the sport, she would have these random matches where she wouldn't play that well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I don't think we should read too much into it unless it becomes a bit of a pattern moving forward.
Yeah. I say the takeaway for Venus is that she's ranked number 11. You know, she has a big year coming up, I think. A lot to look forward to.
She won in Auckland. She made the quarters of the Australian Open. She's jumped 8 spots from those 2 tournaments, which is not an easy thing to do in the top 20. And mm-hmm. she's very close to the top 10. I'm guessing that had Makarova not played so well in Australia, she might have even cracked the top 10.
That is true, I believe. So let's talk about Serena and Madison's semifinal. You know, we saw kind of more of the same from Madison Keys. She was ready to play. She was ready to stretch Serena.
Serena came ready, too.
She did, yeah.
Which made for compelling viewing.
Yeah, you know, when someone beats Venus and Serena has to play them next, she's not messing around. You know, she's amped up. I think something that was really notable about that match was Serena failing to close it out, 8 times?
She had 9 match points, didn't she?
Yeah. So Madison just kept swinging for the fences and kept making it. It was shocking and a little annoying to me. I was ready for it to be done.
Well, she also had most of those match points on her own serve, and I think Serena even pointed to that in one of her post-match interviews.
Mm-hmm.
That saying, you know, credit to Madison, but I feel that had those match points been on my serve, the result would have been a little bit different.
Fair. But it says something for Madison's fortitude that she was able to save match points on her racket.
Yeah.
You know, her serves are going in. That's the point. I mean, she had nothing to lose at that point. You know, she was probably going to lose to Serena Williams, one of the best players ever. So why not swing out, you know? Show people what you're made of.
Well, that's exactly what she did this tournament.
She did.
And on the men's side, Rafa had a rough go of it in the early rounds, particularly against Smicek. Then he kind of pulled it together a little bit in the subsequent rounds, but then there was just no stopping Berdych in that quarterfinal. He steamrolled Rafa.
He did. That match actually happened the day we recorded our last podcast. Mm-hmm. So we were about to witness it after we, you know.
And I believe I had cautioned about talking too much about that match because I was a bit wary of all this talk about the streak of, I think it was 17 matches in a row that Rafa had won.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt a little bit ominous, you know?
I believe somebody called me out for saying that Rafa was going to win easily. I think it was my mom, actually. A little schadenfreude. She's a Rafa fan, though. Don't worry. But yeah, Rafa, I mean, obviously didn't seem himself in the first 2 sets. You know, and it took a lot of effort to get himself kind of pumped up in the third.
I don't really know what to make of that match in terms of Rafa's performance and what we can expect from him, what it means about his comeback from injury and going forward.
Yeah, I don't, you know, a lot of it could have been fatigue. He wasn't really match fit. He hasn't had a lot of matches this year.
We will never know what it's like to play at that level.
Right.
The men's final, the first 2 sets took 2.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And they were playing at such high intensity that it's going to take a long time for Rafa to get back to that level.
Yes.
And credit to Berdych, he was clearly on a roll. He likes playing in Australia, and it was his time for at least one more round. With the results in Australia, we're going to have the big 4 ranked as the top 4 again in men's tennis. And for a lot of people, that's a very exciting thing. I think it's cool, personally. And the reason it's important to a lot of people is that we've seen these 4 players, Novak, Roger, Rafa, and Andy, play such compelling high-level tennis over such long periods of time against each other. They've all played in finals, epic finals. And so from watching them, we're able to understand what the best looks like in tennis. And for me at this point, that's what Big 4 tennis represents. It's not so much the actual rankings, but what we've been taught by these players and what we can then use from knowing what top level tennis looks like to assess and compare other players. So at this point, Stan may not be ranked top five. I think he's ranked eighth now, but we know he can play big four tennis.
Right.
But outside of him, how many of the men's players have we seen actually play to that level? For the only person that's close is Nishikori at this point for me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of players can play supposed big four tennis for a match or for a tournament. You know, it's lightning in a bottle. But what's remarkable about the big four is the sustained excellence, you know?
Somebody like Raonic is ranked in the top 10, easily in the top 10, but his level is nowhere near to what those four can produce over five sets in a Grand Slam.
Right.
And so what's even more helpful if we look at big four tennis through that lens, we can then, you know, extrapolate that to the WTA Tour and say, well, who are the players who play that highest level of tennis and understand where other players sit?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Serena
yeah.
is a cut above, but we've seen Maria, including in this final, play close to her level.
Right.
She can play that level of tennis.
She's a solid top two player, mm-hmm. Maria. You know.
She hasn't been able to bring that necessarily all the time against Serena, but she's capable of it. We've seen Kvitova capable of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if she hasn't already, we're seeing the potential for Venus to play that again. She has in right. the past. You know, those are four players who can play big four type tennis on the women's side. But what's even more useful is that when we want to talk about players like Bouchard and last year with Sloan, for example, as the next big thing,
mm-hmm.
we can really assess where they are in their careers by understanding what their level of tennis is. We haven't seen Bouchard play that level. We haven't seen Sloan play that level. When she beat Serena in the quarterfinals last year at Australia.
2 years ago.
2 years ago. It wasn't because she was playing out of her mind or had risen her game that much. She mm-hmm. was playing well. Serena was injured. But then we then put all these expectations onto her to be the next big thing, when in fact we should know already that her game just isn't at that level yet.
Right. Sloan is really talented. You know, I don't want to beat her when she's down. I think she has amazing potential, but she needs to get her head right. You know, and she needs to find a coach who she really gels with, if she hasn't already. You know, her body language on court is just so bad. You know, she hasn't really shown that she wants to be there.
Well, she's dropped into the 40s now in the rankings. And with Madison Keys emerging to take that mantle from her as the next big hope, you know, maybe the pressure will be less on her and she's able to find herself, so to speak. But this also is why Madison Keys was so impressive these past 2 weeks, because she definitely played that level of tennis. Right. I'm wary of putting that expectation on her, because not everybody is able to deal with it and cope with it and build on it. But there's no denying her talent and what she's able to do. I've never seen somebody stick with Serena at that age so well. Mm-hmm. Like, there was a point where she hit a ground stroke that was so powerful that it knocked Serena back off her feet. And Serena's backhand then clanked into the post of the net.
Mm-hmm.
So we've now talked about the lead up to the final. We can now get right into it. Which one do you want to start with?
How about the one I watched?
It's a recurring
Serena
theme here.
And Maria. So, you know, this is a time I did stay up until 6:30 in the morning.
I will say this might be the latest I've ever seen you stay up.
Well, for tennis.
Well, as long as I've known you. Okay. I can't recall another time.
So this match was a cracker.
Yeah.
It was a lot better than I thought. Maria really took it to her. She came to play.
And it was only two sets, but it felt... I didn't even want a third.
Well, no. I was feeling very tired.
The combination of needing to go to bed or what... But I felt fulfilled by the final.
Yeah. You know,
I didn't feel like I hadn't gotten my non-money's worth.
Your non-money's worth.
I mean... Well, I didn't pay to watch
this
it.
This is the only reason we have cable, though. So we are paying to
that
watch
it. That is true. Yeah.
So, you know, a lot is said about the supposed animus between Serena and Maria and how they hate each other and they have this long-standing dislike. And I think it's clear that they're not friends, but their comportment on court and after the match is very professional.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think there's much to say about that.
At this point, it feels that we've projected more of that onto them than that's actually there.
Right. And they snipe at each other in the media every few years, you know, but it's really not that big a deal.
No. And to say that, you know, they don't necessarily like each other, it's neither here nor there. You play 50 different people on tour every year. You're not going to like all 50 of them.
Right.
But they're perfectly professional toward each other. And, you know, perhaps I've been guilty of it in the past. Maybe we should just let that be at this point, you know?
Okay, fair enough. It's hard enough to be a female athlete with all the expectations thrown at you to be best friends with a player you've played, what, 19 times now and have lost a lot of majors to. It's too much. So
which is not
there's
to say...
me defending Maria Sharapova again.
Again, it might just be the first time.
Perhaps.
And perhaps the last. But this is not to say that their relationship is not complicated. It's complicated by race. It's complicated by a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe we just shouldn't look for drama when there isn't any, you know?
Agreed. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
The match itself, aside from these interpersonal things, the match itself was exciting. It was tense. Serena was sick, obviously, while the roof was closing, while it was raining. Serena went into the tunnel, and the camera followed her, of course, and you could see her having this coughing fit. So me, being a Serena fan, is panicking at this point.
You and all of Twitter were panicking.
It was bad. I mean, it looked really bad.
Well, she also went to the tunnel when she was serving at 30 all, right? And so the added to the panic was that,
yeah,
you know, if she's not feeling well at this point, she could easily be broken when she comes back. But that wasn't the case. She won something like 6 points in a row.
Mm-hmm. And that was early in the first set.
Mm-hmm.
One curiosity about the Australian Open is that they had about 500 children, you know, wiping the court off, but the rain was still coming down on the court. It was before the roof had been closed. It was very strange.
But also, why are we using a bunch of kids to manually wipe the court? It made for very strange viewing.
At the US Open, don't they have these gigantic fans? And then they wipe off the lines.
They have them at the Rogers Cup. I saw them last year.
You have to wipe off the lines, mm-hmm. though, because they're slippery, right?
It just seemed that there was maybe a more efficient way of doing it.
Maybe it's just the quaintness of tennis.
Like, and are these ball kids being paid? You know, there's a question of free labor here, an exploitation of child labor.
Just stop. What are you, some kind of communist? So, oh yeah, we promised we were talking about the match.
I mean, I was infinitely impressed by Marie in that match. You could see that she was always trying to find a way.
Yes.
She was trying drop shots. Even when they weren't the best drop shots, mm-hmm. they worked at times, perhaps because of the surprise factor with Serena. And the tenseness of the match.
Mm-hmm.
But she was trying different ways to get the job done, finally.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't work for her.
Playing down the middle of the court. Mm-hmm. You know, Serena moves better than she used to when she was younger. Or, sorry, Maria. Did I?
Yeah, that was a big slip.
Oh, wow. Maria moves a lot better than she used to. But the thing is, when she plays Serena, Serena does all these things better. You know, and the commentators notice this. Chris Evert says that every aspect of Serena's game is superior, but their mental game is equal, which I take a little issue with.
Yeah, I don't quite buy that. Because there's no overcoming the losses. If they're on equal footing mentally, then you shouldn't be losing to somebody 15 times in a row. Mm-hmm. There's just no way around that.
Because Serena's lost to, obviously, far inferior players, you know?
You would think that over the course of 11 years, she'd have had one slip-up.
Right. So, you know, what I was wondering during the match is Serena more dangerous because she's sick? Because she might be worried about going three sets. And at times it looked like she couldn't quite catch her breath. She had a little coughing. She was congested. You know, was she more determined to get the job done faster? I think her serving reflected that.
See, again, this is something that we'll talk about too with Djokovic coming up. I'm not inclined to speculate about a player's health status during the course of a match, because we just don't know.
Right.
Like, we don't know how they feel. And so I'm more inclined to look at the toughness of her draw leading up to the final, and the fact that she played a bunch of quality opponents, and that she also played Madison in the semifinals, whose power then would have prepared her for anything Sharapova could have thrown at her.
Mm.
She was clearly fit enough to play two sets at a high level.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just going to leave that at that.
All right.
Is there anything else you want to say about the lopsidedness of the draw? It's been one of your favorite topics.
No, I'm done with that.
And so we get to the men's final, the one that you didn't watch.
Sorry, guys.
I watched the first three sets. I had hoped that maybe starting at 3:30 my time, that if I'd given it 3.5 hours, perhaps it might have been close to the end and I'd have seen almost all of it. After the first two sets took 2.5 hours, there was just no way I was going to get through the whole thing. But it was a very strange match. And perhaps you can talk to it from some of the write-ups that you've read subsequent to it. Murray had his chances throughout the course of the match, leading up to the bagel set in the fourth. But he pulled ahead 2-love in the second set, ended up being a tiebreaker that he won to pull even once at all. He was up in the first set tiebreak as well, and gave away that lead. Then he was up 2-love again in the third set, and gave that lead back. And so it wasn't a very good showing for him and his ability to lead from the front against somebody like Novak.
Mm. And Andy seemed to have trouble concentrating during Djokovic's various injuries and maladies and ailments. you know, which is par for the course with Djokovic.
We've seen Rafa and Djokovic play so many times on all surfaces. And so we've been through this before. And so I just can't help but wonder, how was this a surprise to Andy?
It was surprising that he lacked focus in such a dramatic way. Because, you know, we see him screaming at himself over during changeovers all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily a bad sign from Andy.
He's going to be grumpy even if he's up 5-love.
Right.
You know?
Similar to Serena, actually. But, you know, Novak does these things. He does. In matches that he wins, even. He fell and he hurt his thumb. He was sort of stumbling around. He did that at Wimbledon as well. You know, during the course of the final against Federer, there were times when he looked down and out, like he was injured. And
he's very dramatic on court.
Yes.
Like, we don't know for sure if he's flopping, faking, whatever. If I, as just a tennis viewer, can accept that this is how Djokovic plays and that this is going to happen, how then does Murray, in a position where he's tied at a set all and up a break, then allow that to throw him off his game?
Yeah, it's disappointing. And maybe shows you why Murray only has 2 majors and the rest of the big four has many more.
That's, you know, a fair point.
As a Murray fan, I hate to say it, because I think talent-wise, he's up there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he belongs there. But should Murray have won more majors? He's been to the Australian Open 4 times. You know, Novak pretty much owns Rod Laver Arena at this point.
Yeah.
It's his Roland Garros, practically.
Not quite yet.
No, the dominance is nowhere near what Rafa does in the French, but he is pretty damn hard to beat.
It's his favorite court.
Right.
Clearly. But the difference between them in terms of game isn't that big for Andy to be struggling so much against him. It has to be a mental difference between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was no more plain for people to see than in that final a couple nights ago. And very disappointing.
Yes. Now, back to Novak. He really shows a lot of desire to be liked. You know, on most of the big occasions in his career, he has been the underdog. He's not been the crowd favorite. And if I'm being frank, maybe this is part of the reason why. He did come into the top tier of tennis as a villain character, and he's toned it down a lot.
He emerged when Rafa and Roger were fully established as well.
Right.
He was a bit of a late bloomer compared to the other two.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's always had to fight against that, give him that in terms of not being universally loved. Because in a lot of these finals, he's playing either Roger or Rafa.
Right.
So he has that built in against him. But this doesn't help.
It does not help. And the many, many retirements at the beginning of his career don't help either. I'm reminded of Andy Roddick's comments about Novak having bird flu and all these ailments, you know, at the US Open a long time ago. And then Novak went out the next match and, you know, tried to drag Andy Roddick in front of his home crowd. It's it didn't go well. And this is sort of the tone deafness, I think, that Novak can show on occasion.
He has this reputation of being a ham for the press and the fans and what have you. And I've witnessed it. I witnessed it at the Rogers Cup. And yes, he was a little bit overeager. But as a number one player and somebody not playing a Grand Slam, it was really impressive to see him spend and give so much time to the fans.
Yeah.
I think his struggles just come within the lines. Mm. Like, there's no hiding from himself when he's actually on court, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Because after the match, he's really gracious. Mm-hmm. You know, when he won Wimbledon, he didn't do all that macho shirt-tearing crap that he used to do. You know, he was very gentlemanly.
He's very humble off the court. He's very humble when he's losing most times. It's the great paradox with him.
Yeah.
He can be very obnoxious when he's winning, but very endearing when he's losing. Maybe that's his problem. He just hasn't lost enough.
He's hard to like when he's winning. I'm sorry.
Well, that's part of his issue too, right? I spent a lot of time not liking Federer, but over time, even a player's most ardent dissenters, they can come around. Mm-hmm. And so at some point, he's just going to have to find a way to endear himself to people who've already written him off. It's not impossible, but stuff like this does not help his cause.
Right.
There isn't really a whole lot much more to say about the match.
No, it wasn't a classic.
No, and so Novak has... What does he have? 8 slams now? He tied Agassi and Lendl, I believe.
Yep. So and he's, Jimmy Connors.
Yeah, he's getting up there. He's definitely, without question, one of the all-time greats at this point. He's still only 27. Mm-hmm. And so he's got a ways to go. Whether he'll catch Roger, Rafa, whatever, it's almost immaterial at this point because his place is secured in the annals of tennis history. And Andy, again, is just the miserable loser. You know,
how dare you.
I grew to love Andy so much, and his positions on women in sport, his hiring of Mauresmo, the way he speaks about women's sport, those things have all endeared me to him so much off the court. And I'd forgotten what it was like to really watch one of his matches when he's really making it very difficult for his fans, you know?
Mm. Yeah, those qualities that I find endearing about him, his misery, his sourness. I know that's strange to say it is endearing, but
it is endearing.
I like the sort of the honesty about
Andy
Murray.
He owns it,
yeah.
You know?
But those qualities when he's losing and when you feel like he should be pumping himself up, it can be really unappealing. But you know what? Andy Murray's not there to be appealing. He's there to win tennis matches. And he won 6, but he didn't win enough.
At some point, he's going to have to start winning a few more. It may be a bit tough to say this of him now, since, you know, it really was a good result for him. If you had said to any Andy Murray fan before the tournament start, would you take a final? Almost all would say yes.
Yeah, because Federer and Nadal were in his half.
Yeah, and he showed a lot of good tennis. He played well against Dimitrov. He played very well against Kyrgios. And he beat Berdych as well. He had some strong results.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the disappointment, too, because we felt that perhaps he was all the way back and he could build on those performances and actually beat Novak in the final. It would have been a great story, and it just didn't happen. I've been looking forward to this part of the podcast since well before we started.
This is the part where we do karaoke.
This is the part where we talk about a couple of the juicier moments from the last bits of the tournament. And the one that just I can't get enough of was Miss Jennifer Capriati. After Madison Keys beats Venus Williams, she took to Twitter to praise Madison, and something to the effect of, you know, this is how tennis should be played, and I'm so glad to see it being played, and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And of course, fans of the Williams sisters on Twitter were not having it. Because Venus had just played, you know, we're well aware of Venus's story, and she had a great result, her first Slam quarterfinal since 2010. Mm-hmm. And she had nothing to say about Venus. And so folks took exception to that. That precipitated this big victimhood display that she so want mm-hmm. to indulge in.
Yeah, I have to say, I was a big fan of Capriati for years, and she's one of the people who really brought me to tennis. But her social media presence has really sort of torpedoed a lot of the good feelings I've had for her. What I object to is just the constant victimhood. You know, she's always complaining about haters and da-da-da-da and embracing positivity, and it's just so tiresome. It's so tween, you know?
It really is. She had this interaction, a similar interaction with Lindsay Gibbs at one point last year, where she took issue with something that Lindsay supposedly tweeted toward her. Lindsay was at a complete loss of words for what it was about. She had no idea what she was talking about. And then the pattern is that she, you know, plays victim, deletes the tweet, and then talks about some self-help mumbo-jumbo and the haters. Mm. That's what happened then, and this is what happened again today, because I went to go do some research, went back to her Twitter account to find out what she had said, you know, so I could quote it. And of course, the tweet's been deleted. And it's been deleted, and then subsequent to that, she wrote, "Tried to acknowledge and compliment a great up-and-coming American and received utter abuse for it. Nice to see three Americans in quarters of a slam." Which is one of the critiques, right? Mm. That she focused on Madison and didn't focus on Venus and Serena. When in fact, you know, it's a great achievement for American tennis, and that's something that she should be talking about as well.
You know,
even if with Venus and Serena being her tormentors and compatriots, and even, you know, if she doesn't have good feeling toward them, mm-hmm. she can set that aside and play up the larger narrative that it's a great time for American women.
I actually may diverge a little here, and I didn't really find the original tweet that objectionable. For me, it's like the backtracking. She doesn't have a responsibility as a retired player to celebrate anyone.
She doesn't.
And she doesn't have a responsibility to tweet congratulations to Venus and Serena. I don't think there's much love lost between them. Oh yeah, what's kind of gross is just, you know, complaining about the haters and blah, blah, blah.
I agree with you. But my position is that this is not a new thing. This is a pattern of behavior. And there's the fact that Jennifer Capriati could tweet something like that and not be aware of the shitstorm that's going to be coming back to her. That's on her. Mm-hmm. She's not a 13-year-old. She's a big, grown woman.
Right.
You know? And if somebody comes back at you with that, there are ways to deal with it in a civil, professional way that diffuses the situation without then going on to, you know, tweet congrats to Madison Keys for playing some great tennis, enjoy watching her power style, and then saying legends don't need compliments, they know who they are, smiley face. Thanks to all the kind people who still inspire me, keep on keeping on. You're the reason I stay. I appreciate and I'm grateful for those that appreciated and enjoyed what I tried to give, always.
I enjoyed what she tried to give, really.
Yeah, we did.
I loved her.
It was one of the great comebacks in modern professional sport.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is the drawback, well, one of the many drawbacks of social media, when, you know, kind of when your heroes become human and disappoint you, you know?
Because part of it, too, is that we know that girl. Mm-hmm. You know, we've all interacted with that person, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And we know that that person is not somebody you want around in your life.
Now, contrast that with Steffi Graf's social media presence, who I don't think she has Twitter, but she's on Facebook.
Yes. And that shows her age.
But Steffi wrote a really nice congratulatory status to Serena Williams. And, you know, Steffi's distance from the game these days makes her impact more felt, I think. You know, and Serena responded on Facebook. And
she liked it.
Yeah, and she responded.
It's really, really cool to see, you know, a Facebook post from Steffi Graf, and then you see right below it, Serena Williams and 62 million people like this, you know?
Yeah. But I think Serena is still starstruck by Steffi Graf because of her stature and because she's kind of reclusive as far as tennis goes, you know? So that
part,
was
part
nice
of that
see.
Has to do with the timing of their careers too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Steffi had accomplished pretty much everything by the time Serena came on the circuit. They played a handful of times, so there was never a chance for a rivalry to develop. And even if it did, it probably would have been a bit more one-sided, given the stages of their career. Steffi retired with probably a lot more to give.
Maybe, yeah.
She's always been this kind of elusive figure as well, even when she was playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Steffi played her last major at Wimbledon, and Serena won her first at the very next tournament.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, that's a changing of the guard.
Yes.
You know, that's a generational shift.
That is impressively astute. Well done.
You know, the generational change doesn't really get more clear-cut than that.
No. Well, except for that then it was, Serena's like, well, big sis, you take the baton for a few years.
The baton?
The baton.
Oh.
I don't know, whatever.
Is that this a British thing?
This is like one of those moments where my accent gets mangled.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean.
Many influences, yeah.
Yes.
So another juicy moment was...
I love this, these juicy moments.
It came from
Let's
the
talk
mixed
about Martina.
Doubles final.
Yes, please. So Martina Hingis won the mixed doubles tournament with Leander Paes.
Mm-hmm.
Her first Grand Slam title since 2002, more than 12 years.
Yeah, I was shocked to hear that, actually.
Yeah.
I thought she had won doubles titles and mixed, and I just thought she's been around. You
well,
know?
Her comeback was mostly in singles when she came.
Right.
You know, those couple times. But yeah, anyway, so Hingis won. It's a fantastic story, regardless of how you feel about her. She's still only 34. We say only now because we see what the Williamses are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so many older players playing well. And then her opponent in her press conference, Mladenovic, she gives an interview in French where she says something to the effect of she wasn't that impressed with Martina that Leander carried the match. And
there's no way you come out of that looking good.
No, because you just lost in straight sets.
Mm-hmm.
In straight sets, this is a losing position for you to take. A, you're taking the unpopular approach of speaking ill of a legend. A legend who is on the comeback. Speaking ill of a feel-good story. And then you say it in a way that just sounds so bitter.
Yeah, cautionary tale, people.
Yes, seriously. It was good for a good laugh, at least.
The other little piece of drama that actually never was...
Well, should we even be talking about it? You know, maybe Andy will tweet us and admonish us for talking
Please,
about it.
Please, tweet me, Andy.
Tweet? Is that it?
So, the coaching battle, you know, Amelie versus Dani Valverde, who parted ways with Andy and worked with Tomas Berdych.
ESPN, Tennis Channel, everybody was billing it as, you know, this battle royale of the coaches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Danny's now switched camps, and so he has all this inside info, and Andy, he's going to tell Tomas, you know, they're going to be sipping tea, you know, over some crumpets, and he'd like, give him that one little bit of info mm-hmm. that's going to put Tomas over the edge, right? And then Andy comes back, I think, in his press before the semifinal to talk about, well, you know, guess what? Like, I worked with Danny too. Like, I know a little bit of what he would be preparing me for Tomas mm-hmm. as well. But when the match finally happened in their press, Andy really went in on the press corps.
He did. And he really tried to shift the focus from parting ways with Valverde and make it about hiring Maresmo.
It was a really impressive pivot.
Yeah.
Like, it gave you everything. In one breath, he's taking down these, you know, these members of the media. And then he's, in the same breath, using that to promote Maresmo.
Yeah, he gave us an education.
Well, what he said was...
What had happened was...
He said that this whole media frenzy around the coaching situation was just that, a creation of the media, and there really wasn't that much of a story. And you yourself said that you read somewhere that what Danny was saying about
the relationship. I read an interview with Danny, mm-hmm. who downplayed the way that they parted ways, right? Saying that it wasn't contentious, that Andy and he sat down and talked about it for a long time, and that it wasn't about Maresmo. He was very clear about that. So, and he says they're still friends.
Because that's a popular tale, right? That Andy made the decision to hire Maresmo without consulting Danny.
Right. And that caused friction between mm-hmm. them. So we don't know if that's true or not. I think the moral of the story is that it was purely manufactured, this tension between the coaching camps, and it sort of, you know.
There's far too much attention paid to coaches these days.
I don't believe that the casual fan cares.
No.
You know?
I remember when I was in my teens watching tennis, I paid a lot of attention to Brad Gilbert as Agassi's coach, mm-hmm. but that was mainly because I was a big fan of Agassi. And I knew that Hanna Manlikova was Novotna's coach.
Right.
And so I was looking to her during matches. But outside of that, is it really that big of a deal? It's great that Davenport's having all this success with Keys, mm-hmm. but can we really even attribute it to her influence? Like, it's hard to tell.
You have no idea.
No idea. Like, where she's at an age, a developmental age, where she could just be finally clicking things on her own. Mm-hmm. I feel it's likely that the influence of the coach is overstated.
Perhaps. I'm really looking forward to the day when I don't have to see Boris Becker in the stands.
Yes, that would be the day.
But Magnus Norman, you can stay. And Stefan Edberg? Hello.
He can move in. So one of the pitfalls of the Australian Open is that we don't really know what to expect with the players coming off an extended break. Maybe extended is not the right word for how short the offseason is.
Right. Actually, you know, the gap between the Australian and the French is huge. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like a different season.
But historically, you know, results can be a bit uneven in Australia because you never quite know what form players are going to be showing up in, right?
Right.
Coming off of injury or what have you. But we saw a lot of results that we can look to in terms of plotting the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. A lot of really interesting things happened in Melbourne.
Yeah, we saw kind of the old guard, you know, dig in their heels and say, mm-hmm. not yet. There was a lot of posturing on ESPN about Bouchard being the next Sharapova, perhaps. And Sharapova was pretty clear in her play that she's still around.
Yes.
And that there is no next Sharapova because Sharapova still exists.
And she's probably still getting better. It's possible her best days aren't behind her, you know?
Well, I wish her middling success. And, you know, Serena and Venus are old grandmas at this point, and they're not ready to give in to the Madison Keys.
They've got medals to win in Rio.
Right. You know, when Venus lost that match to Keys, she said, you know this better than I, losses like these are good.
She said, losses like these are good. I'll learn from it.
You know, she's 34. She's been playing tennis for 25 years.
Longer than that.
Yeah, longer than that. But
and professionally for 20.
Right. The fact that she still wants to learn from losses like this is amazing. And encouraging.
Yeah.
To people who want to see her stick around.
She lost. It was a match that I felt she could have won. It was disappointing. But the bottom line is she won Auckland. She won former matches in Australia. She's had one loss in the season, one title. She's in the top 10 of every 2015 list so far. Mm-hmm.
She's 7th in the race.
Yeah, she's 11th in the world. Like, the sky's the limit. That's my perspective for her at this point. because if she's able to somehow get out of Dubai with defending most of her points, then she can really do some damage the rest of the year in terms of the rankings.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as Venus is concerned, like, she's got a tussle on her hands now, because with Madison's improved play, she's got her on her heels now for Rio.
Yeah.
Because Serena's going to be the first singles choice, but who's going to be the second?
Mm-hmm.
You would think that with Venus jumping to number 11, you know, it would be a good spot, but Madison's now up to number 20.
Right.
And the prospects of her jumping even further and more quickly are even greater than Venus, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to definitely keep an eye on for the rest of the year.
Yeah, I think they'll play around in Fed Cup with their first mm-hmm. and second singles players, you know, and see what works.
What can we take from Rafa's play at the Australian Open moving forward into the clay season? Because, you know, his quest for a 10th French Open is going to be the hot topic in the next few months.
Yes. It's so hard to tell, honestly. I don't feel like I can add much to the conversation. You know, he looked at times brilliant and at other times sluggish and lost. I think the quarters in general is a really good result for him, especially coming after such a long layoff. So, I don't know. I'm optimistic.
He had unexpected struggles on clay last spring.
Mm-hmm.
And the heartening thing for Rafa fans, based on what we saw last year, was that he has so many opportunities to play himself into form on clay, his favorite surface.
Right.
That even if he doesn't start off well, chances are, barring injury, he should be in good stead
mm-hmm.
come time for Paris.
Yeah, you know, last year he was, that back injury apparently was sticking around for a little longer than we thought. So that could have been part of it.
I'm very interested to see how these are tournaments that he dominates historically over the course mm-hmm. of his career. And so those somewhat middling results last year, it'll be interesting to see how he reverses that, or if that's a trend that continues. If it continues and he still wins Roland Garros, you know, it's mm-hmm. prior to last year, it was just Rafa dominates on clay. He's the king of clay. Don't even bother. He's going to win everything. If mm-hmm. he doesn't win everything, say for maybe Madrid because of the blue clay, then something's wrong.
Mm.
Last year shook that up a bit. So I'm interested to see how that corrects itself or continues this year.
You know, Djokovic is one of the two players who could possibly win a Grand Slam this year. And Roland Garros is his Moby Dick, you know, his.
It's becoming a recurring narrative for him now every year with the French Open. You know, this is a tournament that he wants the most. This is the one that he needs to create his own personal Grand Slam,
mm-hmm.
career slam. And Rafa's always going to be the guy that's in his way. Again, like other years, he enters the clay season with momentum.
Mm-hmm.
He's still number one. We're going to have to live through that again.
And, you know, I think he probably will win one or two of the European tournaments in mm-hmm. the lead up. But he, I don't know, he hasn't shown that he can figure out Rafa at the French. He can beat him in the previous tournament, but, you know, there is like a mental stumbling block there. And people have called some of their matches at the French classics. And to me, they're not. To me, they're kind of ugly and grueling and not wonderful clay court tennis. So it's not actually a matchup that I look forward to.
How many matches on clay for Rafa are anything but like a bulldozing, you know?
Right.
And so if he is going to be pushed on clay, it's the nature of his game that it's going to be a battle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think we should be looking for the beautiful tennis on a surface like clay with those two.
Yeah, fair enough. Now the other player who can win a calendar Grand Slam.
Well, she's a halfway through to another Serena Slam.
That is true. Serena says that she wants more French Opens, that she only has two. She said that recently in the media. And I think she's going to be really motivated because at this point, it seems like she really understands her place in history. She's really happy about passing Everett and Navratilova to have her own spot at 19, you know? I'm not saying that she can run the table, but I think she rolls into the spring in really good form.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's I'm becoming increasingly aware of tennis narratives, and this is another one that I'm uneasy with the Serena being able to win at will kind of scenario. One, I think it's going to take a lot of hard work for her to do it.
Yeah.
And Maria Sharapova has, even though you don't want to hear it, she's earned her spot as the top player in clay the last few seasons. What's that look?
Yeah, but no, I would say the co-top player. So she's won two French Opens. But Serena's record on clay has been outstanding.
It has, but Maria's record in the non-major clay tournaments has been outstanding,
That's too. What I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
The lead-up tournaments, the European tournaments, you know? I think... I wouldn't say that Maria is the clear-cut number one clay court player.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it's a bit easy to then say, based on her history, that she's, you know, stands a good chance of just, like, running away with stuff.
No, it's definitely going to be the hardest major to
it
win
is.
Again.
It's going
to
be, it's not going to be easy. Maybe I'm just being contrary, just for being contrary's sake.
The thing is, there are not many women tennis players who are outstanding clay court players.
No.
You know?
Simona plays well on clay.
Yeah. But Simona and Sarah Errani, like, they're not beating the top players in major finals.
No.
The thing is, there are not a lot of top female tennis players who are outstanding clay court players who are contending for the clay court major.
Yeah. You know, back in the day, you know, Arantxa was a clay courter.
Yeah.
All these different players played well on clay. Right. Same with the men's side. The 90s French Open was dominated by a lot of, you know, clay court specialists, but that's not the case anymore.
Right. But on the women's side, Graf won, Seles won, Arantxa won, you know, the top players won the French.
Mm-hmm.
And these days there's Maria, there's Serena, and there's, you know, there have been a few kind of random champions recently. Kuznetsova, Errani was a finalist, Halep was a finalist, but are these players going to be contending for a major? Halep, maybe. But
I think my point previously was that, yes, Graf and Seles and all these players won on the clay, but there were also players, even if they didn't win, whose game was clearly more suited to clay.
Right.
I think tennis has moved away from that a bit in the 2000s.
Yeah. And we've seen it with the Spanish men, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of them are better on grass. Lopez
Feliciano.
Is a great grass player.
Ferrer doesn't really.
Almagro are hard court players, you know? So...
You know, Vika's ranked 49th now, which is just... sounds so horrific coming out of my mouth. but there is positives to be taken from Australia. She played well.
Mm-hmm.
She beat Caroline in the second round. It's unfortunate for her now that she's going to be getting a lot of tough early round matches when she's trying to rebuild her ranking.
Mm.
But the slate's now clear for her to string together a few good results and get that ranking up in no time.
Yeah, because right now she's just earning points.
Yeah,
you know?
And she's shown that her game is at a higher level than it was when she, you know, tried to come back from injury last year.
Yeah, she's prone to bouts of errors, but, you know, she's getting it together.
So, Vika fans... chin up. Better days are on the horizon. Now that the tournament's over, how long of a break are you going to take from live tennis?
This is bad, but probably until Indian Wells.
Indian Wells. So you're going to skip all of the Dubai tournaments, Doha, all that stuff?
Yeah, because these things aren't on TV where we are.
Yeah,
you know, tennis is so spotty on TV.
You're not really into watching...
I'm not going to sit in front of a
computer.
Yeah, unless it's a major. So, sorry, guys. I think we're going to have some thematic episodes coming up.
Yes.
Rather than based on the most recent results, you know?
Well, we could have talked about it in this episode, but we decided to save it for, as you said, a more thematic episode where we'll be talking a lot about the commentating at the Australian Open and some of the issues surrounding some of the commentators, some of the conflicts of interest. It was really eye-opening in spots.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that next time.
Yes. And I'm also very excited having an episode dedicated to sexism in tennis as well. So that's something absolutely to look forward to. Something I can use my academic expertise on, if you will.
Yeah, we're actually going to be reading from our master's theses. So tune in. It's going to be a 10-hour episode.
It's going to be riveting. Thanks again for joining us. We had a great time, as always. I'm Jonathan. You can find me on Twitter at SportsScribeCA.
And this is James at ElliotJMR.
Two L's, two T's. I hope you're getting a lot more sleep in the coming week or two.
Yes, take a nap or two.